Okay. Good. Good.
Good. It's early enough in the morning where it doesn't.
Right.
It's kind of ends at the beginning.
Yeah. Okay, brother. Well, have you talked to the administration yet?
No.
Okay. They'll give me some information. What we'll have to do is the things that you sign up for on the research staff, we'll try to give you a sign.
I'll come in for the first part of it today.
Okay.
If you'd like.
Mm-hmm. That'd be fine.
Give away.
Sure. Okay. Good. All right. Well, not so good, but at least I know what's going on. Okay, thanks, Mike. Business this morning. First of all, I've got a couple of handouts for your information that you may want to. One of these you want to take for sure, this file number 2 on Greek prepositions. We won't get to this probably till quite a bit later on when we start looking at prepositions, but just keep this in your notebook, and if you want to read it now, that's fine, but we'll get into the details of it later on. And the other handout is a handbook of English grammar. This is kind of this is one they've used for the English class and several other classes. And if you already have one of these, fine. If you don't feel like you need one, I don't think you have to get one. But it's a good review of English grammar and terms like nouns and verbs and pronouns and adverbs and adjectives and so forth that you may have lost a little bit of the fine touch on the understanding of. Will be covered in detail here. So I'm not going to require you to have this, but this is for your. It's available for your benefit. Now, I got to pass a little money box around because they want to charge for these. So let's see. This is file 74. This file number 1 here, or file 74, I guess is what it's called for the English class, is 30 cents. This is the optional one, 30 cents. And then this one on Greek prepositions is 40 cents. So if you've got the change, there's a little change in the box here. If you've got the money with you today, fine, just plunk it in there. If you don't, then just take care of it in the office when you get an opportunity. But be sure and take one today so we don't have to pass them out again. So I have a couple of volunteers here and pass those out. So this file 74, the one that Glenn's passing out, just take it if you want a copy of it. You don't have to have it. And the Greek prepositions, everybody be sure to get a copy of one of Mark's. That one boxed around.
The Greek prepositions.
Yes.
Okay, thanks, Glenn.
Do they start to charge
them? Well, the thick ones they do. Thin ones they don't, but the ones that are, you know. Yes.
Go ahead. Everybody's supposed to have a
charge. Yeah, prepositions, everybody needs to have one of those.
Oh, I'm
okay. Yeah, the optional one is the one on English grammar. So if you didn't get one of these on prepositions, be sure and get one. Everybody needs to have one of those. You won't need it right away, but later on, there's information in that handout you won't find in any Greek lexicon or grammar. So we want you to have a copy of it.
Yes.
Yeah, I've heard that one. I think that's a corollary to Murphy's Law. Yeah.
I testify to that.
Yeah. Oh, okay, thanks. Okay, does everyone have file two then? There you go. And does anyone want a file one or file 74 here on English grammar that doesn't have one? Okay. Tape students that are listening, these will be available in the library, so just go take care of it there. Okay, and then one more thing. The tapes of the Gospel of John reading in Greek are available, and I think you pick them up in the college bookstore. And I think they're charging $2.25 for the tape, and I think they have some used ones still. I mean, or leftover ones that are either used or from the previous batch, and I think they're a little cheaper, just a few cents cheaper. So if you're really tight on money, ask them if they got one of the used ones, and if not, just get one of the new ones. And yeah, it's not, again, it's not mandatory that you get this tape, but for those of you who want them to help you with your reading, go ahead and you can check with Marlene in the bookstore on that. Okay, so those are available now as far as I understand. Let's today, before we get into chapter 7 again, do some more reading. Let's add a little bit to our repertoire here. John chapter 1. I think what I'll do on this, we've gotten as far as verse 13. So I'm going to, I'll read it first. I'll read verses 14 to 18. And so you can hear it once. And then we'll read 14 to 18 all together. And then if we've got time, maybe we'll go from 1 to 18 continuous and then do the whole thing. So from today on, you can add verses 14 to 18 to your daily reading. Okay, so first I'll just read it. You can listen to it, hear what it sounds like. But follow along on the page there so you're seeing the words that I'm saying. So you're getting some connection there. We're starting in John chapter 1 and verse 14. Kai hologos sarx ageneto, kai eskenosen en hemin, kai ethea samatha tein doxan autu, doxan hos monogenus para patros, pleres charitos kai aletheas. Ioannes martyre peri autu, kai kekragen legon, houtos ein hon epon, ho opisol mu erchomenos, empros then mu et gegonen, hoti protos mu ein. Hoti en tu pleromatos autu, hemes pantes elabonen, kai charin anti charitos. Hoti ho nomos dia mouseos edothe, he charis kai he aletheia dia Iesu Christu egeneto. Theon udes heoraken popote, monogenes theos, ho on eis ton kolpon tu patros ekenos exegeseto. See how simple that was? Okay. Let's take an attempt at it all together now. Going back to verse 14, I'll try to slow it down a little bit. And let's just follow along, everybody, if you can, out loud. And it doesn't do any good just to do this mentally. You've got to do it out loud so you can get the connections there. Even if it's not real loud, make sure you're vocalizing. Okay, verse 14 then again. Kai ho logos sarx egeneto, kai eskenosen en hemin, kai ethea samatha tein doxan autu, doxan hos monogenus para petros, pleres charitos kai aletheas. Ioannes martyre peri autu, kai kekragen legon, houtos ein hon epon, ho opisol mu erchomenos, empros then mu gegonen, hoti protos mu ein. Hoti ek tu pleromatos autu, hemes pantes elabonen kai charin anti charitos. Hoti ho nomos dia mouseos edothe, he charis kai he aletheia dia Iesu Christu egeneto. Theon udeis heoraken popote, monogenes theos, ho on eis ton kolpon tu patros, ekenos exegesato. Okay. Let's go back to familiar territory, verse 1 there. Yes. Yes, Glenn.
Verse 15.
Okay.
Now, Paul,
Bezo,
and Prost then has two accents, two accusers.
Yes, okay.
Yes.
Well, this has to do with what follows it. Notice that move that follows it has no accent. And this gets into some accent rules that have to do with what are called enclitics and proclitics. Moo is a kind of word that's called an enclitic. It doesn't have an accent of its own. And so what tends to happen is that the previous word takes the accentual pattern from this word. And if it's a long word, like emprosthen is, you've got three syllables. When you get a long word like that, it becomes awkward to say emprosthen moo. So you get an extra accent on it. It only happens a few times, and it has to do with the number of syllables involved in what's called an enclitic. So we're going to save the details for that for a little bit later on. We're going to look at those accent rules here, probably after we get through the adjectives. We're going to take a little interlude and look at the accent rules so that you understand what's going on a little bit. And notice, too, that, and some of the others, like, protosmu, same thing, protosmu. So you've got a circumflex accent and then another accent, but it has to do with that mu that follows that has no accent. And that's the key.
The mu is making
it, right, exactly. It's as though the mu doesn't have an accent of itself, but because it's another syllable, it's requiring another accent in the word before it. So it has to do with what's called enclitics, and there's another type of word called a proclitic that gets involved in that kind of rules, in those kinds of rules too. Okay, good. I'm glad you noticed that at least, and we will cover the rules though for that kind of thing a little bit later. But notice how when I'm pronouncing it, the mu is almost like it's stuck on. Emprosthen mu, emprotos mu. You'll find that even modern Greek, they have the mu and so forth, so the various forms of the personal pronouns are stuck on real. It's just as if they're part of the word. Okay. Let's go back to John 1:1 then. Let's read. Let's see if we can make it all the way from 1 to 18 here. Hold out. Okay? And then from here on, from the next few weeks anyway, you can go ahead and read through 1 through 18 for your 5 minutes of reading time. Okay, verse 1. En arche ein ho logos, kai ho logos ein pros ton theon, kai theos ein ho logos. Houtos ein en arche pros ton theon, panta di autu egeneto, kai choris autu egeneto udehen. Ho gegonen en auto zoe ein, kai he zoe ein to phos ton anthropon. Kai tophos en tes gotia phine, kai heis gotia auto u katelaben. Egeneto anthropos apestalmenos para theou, onoma auto Ioannes. Houtos eothen eis marturion, hina marturese peri tu photos, hina pantas pistusosin di autu. Ug ein ekenos tophos, al hina marturese peri tu photos. Ein tophos to alethinon, ho potidze panta anthropon erchomenon eis ton kosmon. En to kosmo ein, kai ho kosmos di autu egeneto, kai ho kosmos auton uk egno. Eis ta idia eothen, kai hoi idioi auton u parelabon. Hosoi de elabon auton, edoken autois exousion techna theou genestai. Tois pistu usin, eis to onoma autu, hoi uk ex haimaton ude ex thelematos sarkos ude ex thelematos andros au ex theu egenethesan. Kai ho logos sarx egeneto, kai eskenos en hemin, kai ethiasamatha den doxan autu, excuse me, doxan hos monogenus para patros, pleres charitos kai aletheas. Ioannes martyre peri autu, kai kekragen legon, hutos ein hon epon, ho opiso mu erkomenos, en prosten mu gegonen, ho ti protos mu ein. Ho ti ectu pleromatos autu, hemes pantes elabonen, kai charin anti charitos. Hoti ho nomos dia mouseos edothe, he charis kai he aletheia dia Iesu Christu egereto. Theon udes heoraken popote, monogenes theos, ho on eis ton kolpon tu patros ekenos exegesato. Okay. Are you recognizing some things here as far as what the meaning is as we're going, just from having known what John 1 is all about? It might help a little bit. I don't expect you to learn, formally try to study the vocabulary here by any means. But as you're reading, if you can keep in mind what is being said, if you can recall what is being said, it might help a little bit in terms of accentual patterns and the flow of it and that type of thing. Okay? But I don't expect you to understand all that much of it. Only by virtue of the fact that most of you are familiar with this passage of Scripture. That's one of the reasons we choose John 1, is because most people are familiar with it and because the Greek is relatively simple. If you think the Greek is difficult here, you might want to take a look at the book of Hebrews and do a little bit of reading in there. That's generally considered the most difficult Greek in the New Testament. Okay, and of course some of Paul's epistles get pretty interesting too. Not that they're hard to pronounce, huh? Go ahead. Well, there's a lot of Hebrew idiom. There's a lot of Hebrew idiom coming across in the Greek, and the subject matter dealing with the covenant relationships, dealing with Old Testament things and so forth, involves a lot of vocabulary you don't see. And then as far as Paul's epistles are concerned, there's more complicated vocabulary, and the sentence structures tends to be a lot longer sentences with a lot more dependent clauses and interrelationships like that, whereas John's Gospels, the sentence structure is relatively short, straightforward, not a lot of intricate vocabulary. That doesn't mean it's any more simple theologically. As you well know, this prologue of John is one of the most difficult passages theologically in the whole Bible, but the Greek is very simple. Okay? Any questions? Now go ahead, verses 1 to 18, then you can use as your repertoire now. We'll be adding a little bit as we go and getting some experience with that. I think the tape goes to verse 29, 1 to 29, something like that. And after that, you're on your own. Okay. Chapter 7, where we left off before we took our little test. And we want to continue there, talking about subject and object, starting to look at basic sentence structure. So we're starting with the simplest type of sentence structure. And we left off in section 48. We looked at examples of English sentences of various types to introduce this whole next section, the whole next few chapters. And then we noticed the subject positions in each of those sentences and recognized that the subject is not always just the performer of the action, but the subject is a special position in an English sentence that is defined in a more of a structural manner, primarily using word order in English. Now, section 48, the subject of a Greek sentence also has distinctive formal features. These are not features of word order and are in general much easier to describe. In Greek, the subject must be in the nominative case if it is expressed at all. If it is not expressed by a noun or a pronoun in the nominative case, it must be inferred from the form of the verb or from the context. It may be stated as a general rule that. Now, let me just say a few more things here. You will not always see a noun in the nominative case in a Greek sentence, simply because if the noun is a pronoun type of thing, you know, where he did this or she did this or whatever. Very often that will be contained in the verb form. The verb form is inflected for the person and number of the subject. And so because there's an inflection in the verb form, you don't always need a separate subject stated. So very often you will not see any subject stated. Just the verb form and then the direct object or something like this, and you get the subject idea from the verb form endings. Mm-hmm. They will use pronouns in addition to the verb form for greater emphasis. For example, a me just means I am. But if you say ego a me, putting ego there, the I on top of it, it's very emphatic. So it's like saying I am. It really comes on with much greater strength. So it affords them an opportunity to add emphasis. But normally you won't see it. You know, if you see the pronoun as well as the verb form, then you're automatically receiving an emphasis as you're looking at the Greek. There's no question about it. So it affords them a little bit more expressive ability, although you won't see it all that often. But things like ego e me, that's one of the classic examples that you find in the New Testament. Yes.
Said it was inflected person. Does that include gender?
No, in Hebrew it will include gender, but not in Greek. So,
sexual?
Yeah, person and number. Well, in other words, if you're wanting to know whether it's she or he, for example, that's context. Yeah. If it's clearly referring to a woman, it'll be, you know, all you have really is a third person form, and it could be either masculine or feminine, or neuter. Could be it. So the context will have to decide. In other words, whenever you use a pronoun idea in a context, the pronoun has an antecedent. In other words, you just don't throw pronouns in without, you know, the pronoun is just a short little word that you can use to replace another word. So it'll have an antecedent, and the context will decide what the antecedent is, and whatever that is. And if it's a woman, it'll be translated she. If it's a man, it'll be translated he. If it's a thing, it'll be translated it.
Is that why it's written in? I know it's not always been certain context. Can't be either way, they always take it as he.
Yeah, they always take it as he because the theologians are seeing it as a person, and therefore they translate it he. But technically, as far as the Greek grammar is concerned, it should be just translated it. It's a neuter noun that's got the that is the antecedent. So it would be no problem at all. See, the Greek isn't worrying. The man who's looking at it in Greek isn't worrying about whether, you know, it's person or not, this type of thing. That's a theological superimposition on top of the whole thing. Now, if you know, there is some justification for it if you know it's a person. But in a certain sense, you know, we wouldn't have any objection to the idea that the Holy Spirit is person in a certain sense of the word. But to make it a separate person and set up certain arguments on the basis of that is not justified by the Greek. Okay. So let's look at this rule in italics down here. This is your general maxim for dealing with a nominative case. The subject of a sentence, this is the general rule now, the subject of a sentence in Greek is normally indicated by a noun or pronoun in the nominative case. Now, I said normally because sometimes you may not have anything indicated. Conversely, the principal function of the nominative case is to indicate the subject of a sentence. That's the principal function, not the only function. We'll look at some other sentence structures where nominative will be used a little bit differently. But the principal function of the nominative case is to indicate the subject of the sentence. So the basic connection is associate nominative with subjects and subjects with nominative. Subject of a sentence, nominative. Okay, there will be some refinement of that, but this is the basic rule. Okay, then, section 49, as far as the objects are concerned. What we have said about subjects also holds for objects. The grammatical term object cannot be satisfactorily defined on the basis of meaning, but only on the basis of formal characteristics. In English, the object is usually identifiable from its position in the word order. So again, what he's saying is that the object of an English sentence isn't necessarily always the one that receives the action. That's maybe the most common type of meaning for it. But he's saying the thing that really tells us what the object is the position in the word order in the English sentence. So, thus in the sentence, the dog bit the man, dog is the subject and man is the object. In the man bit the dog, man is the subject and dog is the object. The reversal of the relative spatial positions of the words dog and man indicate a reversal of their grammatical functions. Man in the first sentence and dog in the second are both objects, and they are both the special sort of objects called direct objects. In Greek, the direct object is not indicated by its position in the word order, but by its case, which is in most instances the accusative case. It should be noticed, however, that not all sentences contain direct objects, either in Greek or in English, and that the accusative case has other functions than that of indicating the direct object. Leaving aside these complications for the present, we may lay it down that. Okay, so there are some complications to this, too. Generally, accusative case is associated with direct object, but it gives some qualifications. First of all, not all sentences are even going to have a direct object. Sometimes you may have an indirect object, no direct object. You might have just a subject and a verb with no object at all. So you won't always have a direct object in every sentence. But when you do have, it'll normally be in the accusative case. Now, we will run into some examples later on of certain types of verbs that take dative objects and take genitive objects. But those, when we get to those, it's not so much a matter of just kind of random. There, it has something to do with the nature of the verb and the kind of verb that's involved. So we'll get to those in due time. But the vast majority of the cases, the direct object will be in the accusative case. And there are some other uses of the accusative case besides that of direct object. One of those is certain prepositions take accusative case in the prepositional phrases. And then there's other things like object complements and things that we'll be getting into the next few chapters where we'll get a little bit more refinement on that. However, the general rule then is that in italics here, the direct object in a sentence in Greek is normally indicated by a noun or pronoun in the accusative case. Conversely, one of the principal functions of the accusative case is to indicate the direct object in a sentence. Okay, so basically, as far as our rough rule is concerned, subjects of sentences are in the nominative case in Greek, direct objects are in the accusative case in Greek. Yes?
Okay, so in the case of the subject, mm-hmm. That's always indicated by a nominative case if there is a nominative case in the structure of the sentence. In other words, he says here the principal function
yes.
of the nominative case, and over here it says, one of the principal functions.
Okay. Yes. As far as the nominative case is concerned, there are less complications with the nominative case rule than there are with the accusative case rule. In other words, with a nominative, about the only other thing you run into is a predicate nominative, and that's pretty easy to identify. And that'll be coming, I think, in the next chapter. But that's about the only complication there. And even there, you've still got this kind of a nominative function that's taking place. Then, as far as the accusative, though, you will find a number of different uses there, especially with prepositions. See, there aren't any prepositions that take nominative case, but there are prepositions that take the accusative case. And so some prepositions will be taking accusative case, like pros ton theon, for example. Pros is a preposition, and it takes normally the accusative case. It will take genitive and dative, too, but most often the accusative case. So it's ton theon, accusative case form of that. So what he's saying, what he's trying to warn you about is that just because you see something in the accusative case in a sentence doesn't necessarily mean it's the direct object. It may be the object of a preposition, which those are pretty obvious because the preposition would be just before it. It may be something else called an object complement, which we'll get to a little bit later on. But even there, that's more like a double accusative type of thing. You usually find two things in the accusative then, and they're kind of being put together. So I don't want to get too far into the complexities of this. Suffice it to say that there are some other uses of the accusative, more different uses of the accusative than there are of the nominative. Okay. Section 50, comparison of the Greek sentences with their equivalent English equivalents reveals quite clearly the differences in the grammatical devices used in the two languages to indicate subjects and objects. So here's a comparison of Greek and English. And the S, V, and O here are symbols for subject, verb, and object. Subject, verb, and object. So what we'll see here, I guess he's got about six examples here. We'll see here that the Greek word order is going to vary, whereas the English word order will be consistent. And so sentence number one, Hege eblastesen ton karpon. The earth brought forth fruit. Well, in the Greek, the word order here is the same as the English. Hege is earth, eblastesen is the verb, brought forth, and ton karpon is the direct object, fruit. And notice the case. Hege is like other nouns that have you seen. First of all, what declension is the noun hege in? First declension, and what's the case of this?
Nominative,
and what's the gender?
Feminine.
Okay. So, you can see it's nominative case. And then ton karpon, What do we know about that? Information there. What gender? Masculine. What case? Accusative. And number? Singular. Okay. So, there's your accusative. And there is the subject, hey gay, is in the nominative case. The object, ton carpon, is in the accusative case. And the word order here is the same as it is in English. But look at the next example. To dendron carpus poie. The tree bears fruits. All right? Here, in the Greek, we have the subject first, all right, to dendron, which is a neuter, second declension noun. But then, the next word is carpus, which is what case? And number and gender there. Well, you wouldn't know the gender necessarily without the article, but from the previous one you would. Yeah, it's masculine, accusative, second declension. It's the second declension and it's plural, yeah, plural. So accusative, plural, masculine, second declension. It could be feminine, yes, as far as what you know there, because you don't have the article on this one. But because the word was used in the previous sentence where you had ton carpon, you can get the information that it's masculine from that. But if you saw the word by itself, you wouldn't know. That's right. Yes?
In switching the word order, the subject, object, verb, what would
they have? Well, generally, the emphasis in Greek will be the word that's first has the most emphasis. And then sometimes they have kind of a bipolar emphasis, as it were. The very first thing and the very last thing tend to get a little bit more stress, and stuff in the middle is less stressed. And so here, the emphasis would be the tree bears fruits. It's put a little bit more emphasis on the tree. It's hard to say that in English we could put such a strong intonation on it, but at least conceptually the tree bears fruit. The focus is on the tree. And of course, the parable is talking about the tree, and so there's a little bit more focus on that. Okay. Now, sentence three. Now, notice here that the word order in the English is the same, subject, verb, object. But the Greek word order, first example we had subject, verb, object, now we've got subject, object, verb. And now we'll get verb, subject, object. Agape sen hotheos ton kosmo. Okay, now here, it's God loved the world. In English, we still have subject, verb, object. God loved the world. But in Greek now, we've got verb first. Agape sen, hotheos ton kosmon. And there you get a little bit more emphasis on the agape sen. God loved the world. You see, it's a little bit more strength and emphasis on that. But notice again, here your subject in the Greek, now even though it's coming in the second position in the sentence, has the nominative case, hotheos. That's what's telling you it's the subject. Not the word order, but the fact that it's nominative. And ton kosmon is accusative, and that's telling you that it's the direct object. It's not the word order that's telling you that, it's only the case endings that's telling you that. You could rearrange this any way you wanted to, as long as you kept the article with the nouns. You could say ton kosmon agapisen hotheos. You could say hotheos agapisen ton kosmon. You could say hotheos ton kosmon agapisen. You could say ton kosmon hotheos agapisen. You could, you know, rearrange that any way you wanted, as long as you kept the articles with their nouns, and you still get the same meaning with slightly different emphasis. And you still be able to read that sentence and pick it apart and know exactly what's the subject and what's the object on the basis of the case functions. It takes a little bit of exposure to Greek to start getting that, because we're so used to having a certain word order pattern. But after you get familiar with Greek, when you're looking through, you're noticing those case endings and getting the information, even without having to re-scramble the whole thing and put it back into English form, you'll find that you'll be able to read it through in the Greek and take it in the Greek word order and understand exactly what's happening without having to retranslate it back into English. That will take some time, of course, but that's eventually what will happen, because your mind will start picking up the Greek patterns and getting the information from the patterns of the grammatical devices that are there. Okay, so that's a verb, subject, object word order now. And the fourth sentence, phone ton numphion ho architriklinos. Now, this is the steward calls the bridegroom. Now the verb here is phoné, and it's coming first. Now then in this sentence, the object is second, ton num theon, and we're getting the information that this is the object from the fact that it's in the accusative case. And then ho archa triklinos is the subject, even though it's coming last in the sentence, because it's in the nominative case. So we know it's the steward, the archa triklinos, that's the subject. He's the one that's calling, and the one he's calling is the bridegroom, ton num theon. So there's a verb object subject word order. Okay, then the next example, we have exousion eche ho huios. The son has power. Here we have the object first, exousion, in the accusative case. And this is a first declension. It's actually feminine, but you couldn't tell for sure there just because you don't have the article. But it's first declension, feminine, singular, accusative form. And then eche is the verb form, and ho huios is the subject, nominative, second declension, masculine noun. So there is object, verb, subject. And then the last one, we have object, subject, verb. So we have the six permutations of the possible combinations of these things you have, and you're finding examples of those in the Greek text. So this one says, ampelon, anthropos, ephutusen, a man, planet of Ein. Okay, here we have object first, then subject, then verb, the very last thing. So, and here, the emphasis would be more upon the vine, ampelon, a vine the man planted, or a man planted, you might say. Okay, but again, in English, the subject, verb, object, word order is basically the word order you'll find. Now, we did talk the other day about the fact that in poetic uses and certain types of writing and so forth, English may even change the word order a little bit to put a little bit different emphasis and intonation. But as far as the normal course of events is concerned, you generally find this word order, at least in conversational English. But in Greek, conversational or otherwise, you're liable to see lots of different word order. It's the case endings that are determining the function. Okay, most native speakers of English will recognize that the six sentences that right above all have the same structure. Each has three main constituents. Each of these occupies a characteristic position. These characteristic positions taken together are parts of a characteristic structure or pattern which we may represent by the formula noun 1, verb, noun 2. So that's the basic pattern that you're seeing in English. A noun, verb, followed by a noun. And we sub-label those nouns, noun 1 and noun 2, to indicate the word order involved. So noun 1, verb, noun 2 is the basic pattern you're seeing in all of those English sentences. Subject, verb, object. In which nouns 1 and 2 are nouns and verb, V is a verb, defined in terms of paradigmatic or syntactic characteristics. If V is a transitive verb, then noun 1 is the subject and has the structural meaning performer of the action. And noun 2 is the object and has the structural meaning receiver of the action. So now he's saying that these formal, more refined meanings for subject and object are dependent upon the type of verb that you have. If it's a transitive verb, if it's of a certain class of verb, and you find noun 1, verb, noun 2, and the verb is a transitive verb, then noun 1 is going to be the subject, noun 2 is going to be the object. Now, by transitive verb, he's got a footnote here for a definition of what transitive verbs are. And he mentions, I guess I didn't read footnote 1, but the English sentences also have the same intonation pattern. We cannot compare this with anything, however, because we don't know the intonation patterns of the Greek sentences. So he's saying that we use intonation pattern as well as word order to determine these things. But because we don't really know what the intonation patterns of the Greek was, we can't really compare this and see if there's any similarities. Now, the second point is what I want to emphasize here on this footnote 2. A transitive verb is one which has both active and passive forms. That's how we define a transitive verb. It's got both active and passive forms. You may have heard also the definition of a transitive verb as being one that can take a direct object. And really, those are pretty similar definitions, because in order to have a passive form, a verb has to be able to take a direct object. Because, you see, when you have an active sentence, the dog bit the man, you have an active verb form, and that verb is a transitive verb because it takes a direct object, man. Now, if it didn't take a direct object, you wouldn't be able to make a passive form out of it, because in a passive construction, you take the thing that was the direct object and make that the new subject. If a thing never had a direct object and couldn't take a direct object, it can't become the subject of a new type of verb. So they're really the same kind of definition. So basically, a transitive verb is one that can take a direct object or one which can have both active and passive forms. So we can say that the man was bitten by the dog. That would be a passive transformation of that sentence, the dog bit the man. We could say the man was bitten by the dog, and we can have a both active form, bit, and passive form, was bitten, out of the same verb. So that would be called a transitive verb. Here's examples here he gives. The verb rent is transitive, since we have the tenant rented the house as the active form, and the house was rented by the tenant. That's the passive form. So that's a transitive verb. It's got both the active and passive forms. On the other hand, the verb come is not transitive, since we can have the collie came home, but not home was come by the collie. See? So we don't use that in a reversible way. We don't normally use. I suppose a person could say that last sentence, but he'd be considered a little strange to the language. So and then verbs like the verb to be or to become, those are even in a more special and restricted class of the intransitive verbs. So the major distinction here is whether it can take an object or not, or more readily, whether it can have active and passive forms, both. So verbs that are transitive can have both active and passive forms. And verbs that are transitive, take direct objects, can have active and passive forms. When those verbs are used and you have a noun, verb, and noun, the pattern will be subject, verb, and object. And there's a more specific example. So that's his equation B here, subject, verb, object. That's a less general formula. You see, this first formula, N1, verb, N2, is a more general formula. You'll see that there are other sentence types, besides those that have transitive verbs and so forth, that follow the same pattern, although the nouns may have different cases in Greek, and you'll see that in a little bit, next chapter, I guess. But if it's a transitive verb, then the first noun will be the subject, the second noun will be the object, and you'll have subject, verb, object pattern, which is a more specific case here. Okay. Now, when we turn to the Greek sentences, however, we discover, section 51, that the formal features which they share with each other are not features of word order. Each Greek sentence contains a noun in the nominative case, so we'll put N with sub N there. We have to do this. We can't use 1 and 2 because word order isn't going to be a factor in Greek. What's going to be a factor in Greek is the case ending. And so they'll label the first noun, what corresponds to the first noun in English, as noun in the nominative, and then a noun in the accusative case, noun n sub a, and a verb. But these three constituents do not appear in the same order in any two sentences. If we, at least in the examples he gave, if we look up the lexical meanings, of the Greek words, we find that English noun 1 corresponds to the Greek noun in the nominative, English noun 2 to the Greek noun in the accusative, and English verb to the Greek verb. He's got to put another footnote down here. At this stage, we shall use only sentences in which the correspondence English noun 1 equals Greek noun, the nominative, English noun 2, the Greek noun, accusative holds true. The exceptions which may occur will be considered later. The exceptions have to do primarily with cases in which you may find a certain verb in Greek that takes its object in, say, the dative case or in the genitive case, and that would be a slight exception to this. You'd have a different case for that second noun. But that is largely determined by the nature of the verb itself, and you learn when you learn the verbs whether if they're unusual in this respect. And as we get to those examples, you'll see that there is some rationale behind it. It's not just a matter of blind chance. There are reasons why certain verbs would be likely to take a dative or a genitive object. When we understand the basic functions of those cases, and after we've looked at them for a while, I think you'll be able to see that without any problem. All right. So it thus appears that in Greek, when V is a transitive verb, noun in the nominative indicates a subject, S with the meaning performer of the action, and noun in the accusative indicates the object with the meaning receiver of the action. So it's basically the same in Greek except for this word order feature and the fact that Greek uses the nominative and accusative cases to do the same thing. Then the last section, structure SVO, subject, verb, object, with fixed order in English, variable order in Greek, is a characteristic of a great many sentences in both English and Greek. But there are many other sentences which have different structures. The structural meanings which we have found to be associated with the subjects and objects which occur in the sentences with the structure subject, verb, object will sometimes be associated with them in other kinds of sentences, sometimes not. We must therefore first recognize which words are subjects, objects, etc., on the basis of formal characteristics such as word order in English or case in Greek. Then we must determine what structural meanings these subjects, objects, etc., bear by examining the whole structure of the sentence in which they are constituent parts. Well, that's going to become more obvious. That's a lead-in to the next few chapters, where we'll be dealing with other types of sentences in which we may have a subject but say no object, or something different than that. We may have two things that are called, might fit into this picture pattern called the object, and they both fit into that pattern. So we'll be looking at the details of that in the next few chapters. Okay. Any questions on chapter 7? Well, we'll go ahead and assign then for tomorrow the exercises in the workbook on lesson 7. I think it's A, B, C, D, E, and F. They're all real short ones. But this will be a matter of finding and identifying subjects and objects and sentences and so forth. So exercise 7, A through F, I think, is the last one, isn't it? So go ahead and do that for tomorrow. We'll correct it in class, and we'll find out if you're really getting it or not. Okay? And in the time remaining, we'll go ahead and start with chapter 8 here, unless there's any other questions on the subject and object relationship. Main thing to recognize is that Greek is using case to determine these things, and then be also aware of the fact that there are more than are other sentence structures besides just the simple subject-verb-object type of relationship. And that's what chapter 8 is going to get into. Okay, section 53 in chapter 8, other sentence types. Many English sentences occur which do not have the structure subject-verb-object, which we examined in the preceding lesson. In some of these, namely those which are structurally parallel to sentence 2 of section 45, the judge coughed apologetically, the subject has the same structural meaning as that which we've already learned, the performer of the action. The structure of this sentence may be represented by the formula subject, verb, adverb. So here's a somewhat parallel case. Instead of an object, now we've got an adverb, but we still have a subject, and the subject still has the same basic function in the sentence. It's still the performer of the action in this particular sentence type. So in which S represents the subject, V the verb is before, in which ADV stands for adverbial adjunct. Okay. Notice this footnote here. We enclose the symbol ADV in square brackets to indicate that it is not obligatory. That is, it is not an essential part of the structure. We may also have, as a complete sentence in English, the judge coughed. No adverb, you see. Non-obligatory or optional constituents may also occur in the sentences of the subject-verb-object type. For example, the treasurer maliciously misappropriated the funds. So there'll be, in this case, maliciously would be an adverb that would be stuck in, maybe in brackets in this particular sentence type, if you want it. It's not a necessary part. So there's other things that can be stuck into sentences that aren't necessarily necessary parts. So we find in this case, subject, verb, adverb. The adverb there is put in brackets because we may just have a subject, verb structure with no adverb at all. Yes?
Wouldn't that be the case with all adverbs?
Well, they'd all be optional, yes. They'd all be optional. In other words, there's no sentence type that is totally dependent on the adverb. At least none that I can think of. And that'll be true in Greek, too. So anytime you see adverb, it'll probably be in brackets just because it's never going to be a necessary constituent part. Okay. The Greek, then... Well, first of all, he uses a more general formula, N1 verb adverb. We continue to use the notation N1 as the subscript provides a convenient indication that the subject comes first in the word order. But there is now no N2. The verb in this sentence is intransitive, that is, one which takes no object and which has no passive voice. Okay, so in this particular sentence, the verb coughed is an intransitive verb. Now, that at least normally, gives a footnote down here on this page. It says, see footnote 2, page 40. Many verbs which are ordinary, that was where we defined transitive versus intransitive. Many verbs which are ordinarily intransitive may be used transitively with a restricted number of objects. Thus, we may have the judge coughed a great hacking cough. So it is possible to cough a cough. And you could say the cough was coughed by the judge, you see. So it's possible with a certain type of, a certain restricted class of objects, a verb like this can be transitive. But most of the time it's intransitive. Most of the time you're not coughing something. You know, you could cough a cough or something like that, but there's only a few restricted things that you could use in that way. Okay, such exceptional examples may be included in the sentences of the subject verb object type. All right, section 54 then was getting into the Greek aspect. Many Greek sentences have a structure which is comparable to this. In Greek, of course, the order of the constituents is not fixed, but once again, the subject, which is indicated by a noun in the first position in English, is indicated by a noun in the nominative case in Greek. The correspondence English noun 1 is the equivalent to Greek noun in the nominative still holds. A few examples will suffice to illustrate this correspondence. So actually, we've got very little to do to change, to modify what we've understood already as far as including this new sentence type in Greek. Luke 21:8 example, ho kairos, engikin, the time is at hand. Okay, here we have the subject and the verb form, and no adverb in this particular case. Apethanen ho plusios, the rich man died. Okay, here again, subject and verb. And ho paideon uk apethanen, the child is not dead. So here's examples of subject and verb, and simple examples just like what we've seen in English. From the third example above, it will be seen that when there is a noun, when the noun in the Greek tense is the sentence is neuter, we may not be able to tell whether it is a subject or the object, since we cannot tell whether it is nominative or accusative. However, it is clear from example 2 that the verb apethanen is intransitive. It has no object. So that to paideon must be the subject in sentence 3. Okay, that's quite clear, isn't it? Point here is he's making is in looking again at sentence 3. When you have a neuter noun, remember there's an ambiguity because the neuter nouns have the same form in the accusative as they do in the nominative. So the ambiguity would be... it'd be hard to... In other words, just looking at the Greek structure, there might be a question as to whether to paideon is the subject or the direct object. But the problem is that the verb to be dead, apethanon, apethanon here, isn't you can't make that into a passive form. And so it's not going to take an object, therefore this has got to be the subject. That's his whole point. Yes?
Well, number 2, the rich man died, he's translating that to be in the past tense, but in sentence 3, apethanen in the same form, he's saying it's in the present tense, is dead.
Yes.
So what happened? Should the sentence 2 be the rich man is dead instead, or is the sentence 3 should it be the child has not died or something? Because how did he change the...
Yeah, he's done that mainly because of the English idiom. Actually, the Greek is an aorist form in both cases. It's exactly the same form. You can see that right from the Greek there. So, to be a little bit more accurate, the third sentence should be translated, the child did not die. The child did not die would be a little bit more accurate. To say the child is not dead, actually, if you want to say that, you could probably use a perfect or something like that in Greek. It'll be a little bit more accurate that way. Huh? Well, yes, a perfect, though, in Greek gives you the idea of something happened in the past that's got a present result. So, in other words, if somebody's dead, they died at one time, and this is the state they're in. You see? See what I mean? Yeah, right, they're still dead. Okay. So that's probably what you... In other words, the phrase, the child is not dead, would probably be done with a perfect tense form in Greek to get the same idea in English. So the problem is that the aorist is an indefinite... it's past action, but it's got an indefinite aspect to it. And that's why he's taking a little bit of liberty here. So that's probably not a very good example, because if you see that it's the same form in both cases, why is he translating it past there and then a kind of a present state of type of idea in the second? I would say, just to alleviate that confusion, you'd probably be more accurate to say the child did not die rather than say the child is not dead. It's just because the English idiom and the meaning of the verb to die, it's got a very permanent nature to it, as it were, you see. And once it's happened, there's a present result. And that's mainly just because of the English idiom that he's done that. Okay? Mike?
Wouldn't that... His thing that if you just saw that sentence, could it be translated with the subject of subject verb object type thing? That's what he's trying to say. Mm-hmm. It can't be, but if the verb contains the idea of he, for example, if you say he died, not the child.
Right. Well, no, you wouldn't. The ook there is coming right before the verb, and I don't think you could really do that in this case. His point, though, is if the verb was a different type of verb, for example, if the verb was loved instead, was agape sin, for example, and you suppose you had topaideon ook agape sin, that could be just as easily he did not love the child, or the child did not love. Could be either one. And the only way you could tell there would be from context, because topaideon could be either nominative or accusative. Context alone would be the thing that decided it there. In this case, though, because apethanen is an intransitive verb, then you've got to have a subject there. I mean, the topaideon has to be the subject. It can't be the object. You don't die something, you see. Okay? You may kill something, but you don't die something. Yeah.
That really shows an example between transitive and intransitive, because if you use begotten, it's that the child did not love. It's got a silent accusative to it. You've got to love something.
Yes. Yes, you can pick another verb then, I guess. The word love is almost begging for an object. You can sometimes in some context talk about it in the conceptual sense of having love versus not having love, loving versus not loving, but normally we use it in as directed towards something. And even there, like you say, there's a kind of a silent object to the thing. Okay. By the way, Trinitarians use that point to argue that there must have been a pre-existing Christ, because God is love, and he has to have an object of his love. Before man came on the scene, there must have been somebody else there that he loved. Okay. All right, we'll stop there, and tomorrow do the exercises for Lesson 7 and then continue further on in this. Okay, you didn't. You need both of them?
Right.
Okay, here's the English one. Here's, if you don't have it with you, oh, you paid for it already. No problem. Anybody not get the handout?
The handout? Yeah, I need
that. For those that came in late, the handouts are, they're 70 cents for both of them. If you didn't have any money with you today, just take it into the college office when you get a chance. Tony, you need both of them?
Yeah.
Okay.
I made up the tape that I'm down off there.
Okay. Yeah, I got it, Chris.